try.
I just figured I'd throw it out there.
I mean, if you go on your way to the Getty Museum with Michael, then yeah, if you guys want to all go together, that would be fine. Okay. Let's get cranking here. All right. We have liftoff on all ends. They're here. Good. All right, friends. Let's pray. We'll get cruising here. Thank you, Lord, for this evening, God. Thank you for this time we have together. And I know even though it's the beginning of the week, some of us are tired. And maybe we're just, I don't know, ready to just go in for the night and just chill out. But we have class, and so, Lord, I pray, God, if anybody here is just tired or worn out, God, that you would revive and refresh, Lord. Do the same for me, God, so that I would be able to communicate everything that you want me to share tonight, God, that we would all just be alert and able to just connect the dots and understand what's going on here, and to just get, again, a fuller picture, Lord, of your work in your church. And so thank you again for these students, Lord, and just for their diligence, Lord, their hard work, their attentiveness. Really appreciate that. So thank you for them. Bless them tonight in Jesus' name. Amen. Yeah, you guys are good. There's Ron rolling in. Okay.
Dumb anyway.
Thank you, sir. So Daniel's gone tonight. Dun, dun, dun. All right. So, I always like to start with a little quick review, right, in case we forget what happened in our last episode, right, previously on NCIS. That's my favorite show, so that's what it reminds me of. Anyway, anybody else like that show, NCIS?
That's my mom watches. She watches that show and all the crime drama shows.
Like crime shows are great, yeah. Whodunits? Well, it's better than like watching a soap opera or something. I mean, yeah, there's worse than that. That's for sure. Yeah, I know. Yeah. See, there we go. Yeah, James. No, just kidding. We're on your mom's side on this one. Sorry. Okay, so just to review, last week we looked at how after the time of persecution, the intense persecution of the church at the hands of the Roman Empire. A certain emperor came to the throne who changed all of that, who changed the whole scene. And what was his name? Constantine. He, like, mixed it up, right? And his accession to the throne as the emperor of Rome and his subsequent conversion to Christianity in 312, that suddenly changed everything for the church in a radical way. For one thing, his conversion meant the end of persecution, right? He gets saved and he declares the edict of, anyone remember?
Toleration,
right? That Christians are now free to worship as they please, right? So he gave freedom in that sense. So that was one major change for the church. But we also saw a change that he brought to the church that unfortunately was kind of negative. He brought about a mixed marriage of church and state, exactly, right? Church and politics, church and the world. Either way, it was not a good thing for the church, right? And that's where we see a parallel with the church of Pergamos in Revelation, because what does the name Pergamos mean? Yeah, unholy and objectionable marriage, that kind of a thing. Yeah, good. So that's kind of the idea there. So you see even some parallels there with the doctrine of Balaam and all of those kind of things, that mix of worldliness and godliness that's not healthy. And so under Constantine, the state began to assimilate the church basically into its own system. And so the two became kind of an inseparable entity. Later, there were other emperors that came on the scene to kind of further develop this concept of church and state. And their names were? Does anyone remember? Well, dang, Theodosius and
Justinian.
Gosh, you guys are so, it just warms my heart. This class is so with it. All right. This doesn't always happen. You guys are kind of a rare group. I'm stoked. All right. Theodosius and Justinian, right? They carried on this idea of church and state. Theodosius was the one who actually made Christianity the official religion of the empire. And then Justinian developed the law of church and state in a written form in the Code of Justinian, right? So he kind of articulated the whole concept of church and state ruling society together. One other major ramification of Constantine's reign that we discussed was the division of the empire. And when the empire divided, because the church and the empire were kind of married now, right? Whatever political decisions were made, the church was dragged into them automatically. And so the division of the state into eastern and western halves of the empire, right? Sorry, I shouldn't say just the division of the state. The division of the Roman Empire into east and west also eventually brought about the division of the church into eastern and western halves of the church, right? And what were generally those two halves called? The Western Church was called the
Roman Catholic.
Yeah, Roman. Yeah, well, for now we'll say Roman. Yeah, it is Roman Catholic, but for now we'll just call it Roman. Yes, good. And what was the Eastern one? The Orthodox. Yeah, the Byzantine or the Orthodox Church. Very good. And we talked about that a lot last week. And so we have the Eastern, Western halves of the Empire, Eastern, Western churches now. And so unfortunately the church was kind of irreparably divided from this point on. And so that's why we're looking at each branch separately. That's why last week we spent the whole time looking at the Eastern branch of the church and its history. And the main reason that we only covered the Eastern Church for one class period was because there wasn't a lot of growth and a lot of development or dynamic that happened, over the course of history. It's kind of stayed largely the same, which is one reason why they call themselves Orthodox, which means, you know, true set of beliefs or something like that. They believe they are the true church because they have stayed so much the same. But unfortunately, what that really implies is that they're stagnant, right, and kind of stuck in being the way that they've always been. Although there is kind of an impressive element to it as well, that, wow, they've been able to maintain their identity. And the main reason, I mean, there were lots of factors, but does anyone remember maybe some of the reasons why that church never really was able to flourish as much as the Western church was? The West had all the dynamic and the development. That's why we're going to cover it more. Does anyone remember what some of the things that happened in the East?
I thought the East was very missionary-based, though. I thought they were.
Well, maybe in the early days, but as time went on, they kind of, like the Russian Orthodox, they were missionary on a certain level, but not in the same way. It didn't really develop and grow and change the way that the Western Church did. Lack of creative movements. They didn't have a lot of that. Does anyone remember the why? Maybe I better just tell you. They were oppressed, yes. That was the main reason why they never had a chance to do a whole lot, why they became so internal, why they became so kind of shut off and trying to maintain their sense of identity, which is normal for persecuted groups of people, oppressed groups of people. They become a little bit more inward, like, well, we got to just hold our ground here. We can't really advance or do a lot. We kind of just got to hold our ground. Exactly, girl. And does anyone remember some of the groups that persecuted or that oppressed them? There's an observation, yes, the Turks and the Ottomans? Oh yeah, the Ottomans. We didn't really get into them that much. But then there's another group that's pretty big deal right now. Islam. Yes, the Muslims, right? There was the Muslim Empire as well in the 700 to 900s that also oppressed the church. Good, guys. I knew I could pull it out of you. Well done. Okay. That's usually a lot deeper than I go during the review. Sorry. Right, so they were persecuted as a result. They were never able to thrive in the same way that the church in the West was able to. So from this point on, we're basically going to be looking at how the Western church developed and how it became so strong and what came out of all of that. So, are we good? All right, so with that, we're going to move on to what was happening within the Western church during the time of Constantine and following. So we're going to be looking at, first tonight, how the church kind of helped empower itself, basically. We looked at how the emperors empowered the church, right? We saw that last week when we looked at Justinian and Theodosius and Constantine. Now we're going to look at church leaders and how they empowered themselves. And again, this was what took place in the Western church primarily. So all those emperors, they played the key role in a key part in defining the roles of church and state, bringing about the marriage between the two. But as we saw during the reign of Theodosius, the church was subtly becoming more assertive and more powerful in its role, even in affairs of state. And you guys might remember that. Remember after the riot in Thessalonica, where Theodosius was an idiot and he trapped all those people in the arena and had them killed, and then Bishop Ambrose forced him to come and publicly repent and, you know, humble himself before the church so that he could receive communion again. That was a major step in the relationship of the church and state, where we suddenly see the church starting to take a more prominent role. Not just prominent, but even preeminent over the state. So we see that starting to happen at that point. And I mentioned that to you guys last week. Really, I mean, this was not a healthy, wonderful marriage between church and state. It was a kind of an unhealthy marriage because you got two people trying to be the head and always going at it with each other. So it could get really ugly, as we'll see next week and the weeks following. So we saw how the bishops had been emerging at that same time, as leaders in the church to combat heresy and stuff like that, all right? So we see all these things happening. We see, you know, the church becoming more assertive and more, you know, having a stronger voice, even in state affairs, even stepping into, you know, not punish, well, yeah, kind of, punish the emperor or rebuke him or whatever the case may be. But we also see, and you guys remember this from a couple weeks ago, where I was talking about how the bishops in the churches were emerging and becoming more prominent within the church as the leaders, as the ones that people look to. And so the problem was, I mean, that was fine. You know, you could understand why it happened, because they were trying to combat heresy and say, no, we have leaders that were descended from the apostles, that had Jesus had, you know, appointed and all that sort of a thing. But now, well, the church has the backing of imperial power, and this began to happen to an even greater and not so necessary degree, where the church leaders are beginning to take more and more power and more control. And so here's where we really start to see during this time, so this would be like in the 400s and 500s, we start really seeing a little bit too much of man getting into the church and getting in the way. And it wasn't just because of Constantine and the emperors, although that had a lot to do with bringing all of that original paganism and stuff into the church, as we talked about. But within church leadership itself, we start to see more and more worldliness, more and more of man, more and more corruption going on. And again, a lot of this was affected by all that paganism that had infiltrated since the time of Constantine. And so what took place in Rome is key, because that dictated what would happen throughout the empire in the long run. Even though Constantine had moved the center of the empire from Rome to what city?
Constantinople,
very good. All right, he moved the capital over to Constantinople in the east, which took away a lot of Rome's political power, but that didn't mean that everybody suddenly forgot all about Rome. Like, oh, Rome, yeah, I've heard of that city. No, of course, they all knew. Everybody knew about Rome. Rome was still pretty prominent, and they never lost all of their prestige in the west. As far as the church was concerned, Rome always was a very important western influence on the other churches, because, well, really, a lot of it had to do with its size, you know, the location, you know, that it was in the capital city. It was a wealthy church in the sense that they had a lot of resources. Not always wealth in a bad way, but early on, you know, they just had a lot of resources available to them. They also did a lot of good works. There were a lot of really good things that the early Roman church did. And honestly, that's kind of what happens in the church today, right? The big churches are the ones that get talked about, that get noticed, right? I mean, that's just how it is. The little tiny churches, which in some cases might be more alive and spirit-filled, they a lot of times don't get noticed just because they're small, okay? Unfortunately, that's just the way it is. And it's not always bad. It's just how things are. So as early as the 100s, Irenaeus, he was a great church father in some ways, but there were some things he said where I was like, gosh, this guy was just like out to lunch. He led everyone down the garden path here. He said, it is a matter of necessity that every church should agree with the church in Rome on account of its preeminent authority. It's like, okay. I mean, and I suppose what he was going for there was unity, that everybody be on the same page and make sure we're all, but it just, you could see how this could lead to some bad things. If you get the wrong kinds of people in leadership, which again happened after Constantine's time, once he brought all that paganism in, and people that didn't really have hearts for the Lord started infiltrating the church and wanting to work their way in the ranks, right, for position and so that they could have favor with the emperor. You know, you get people like that with mixed motives coming in, and that kind of a mentality would cause problems. They're like, well, if the church in Rome is prominent, I want to be a part of that, right? So, since Rome's church was important, Rome's bishop naturally received prominence among the churches. You know, when you got people like Irenaeus, one of the church fathers, saying that, it's like, well, okay, I guess we have to look to the church in Rome. We better look to the bishop in Rome. In fact, throughout the 300s and the early 400s, several things began to happen that elevated the importance of Rome and ultimately the church itself in world affairs, even more so than in the early years of the church. And so we're going to run through it. Some of this was in your book, but I like to just tie it all together for you guys, so you get to hear it a second time and really hopefully solidify what was going on. So, the Council of Constantinople in 381. That was an event, one of those kind of events that really helped, well, I guess you could say really gave an opportunity for the Bishop of Rome to clarify his authority and his position. What happened was, at this council, Emperor Theodosius declared that the authority of Constantinople as the new Rome was not just the political seat of power, but it deserved to be the religious seat of prominence. And so he placed it right next to Old Rome, the original Rome, as kind of the seat of authority. And Damasus, who was the bishop of Rome, when he heard that, he's like, whoa, wait a second, you can't put Constantinople up on the same level as Rome. You can't do that. And so he said, he protested on the basis that church influence should not be based on political influence. Like, just because Constantinople is the key political city now, just because you've made it the capital of the empire, does not mean that it should be the capital of the, or the head of the church as well. You know, really the whole thing was kind of a political move on his part, ironically. I mean, Damasus was, anyway, whatever. So he stated that just, again, just because the city of Constantinople was so important did not mean the church there was so important also by default. He argued what he said was a more spiritual premise, and this is where Damasus introduced what we know as the Petrine theory, the argument that Jesus had given his authority to the Apostle Peter when he said, on this rock I will build my church. And that authority was then passed down to the Bishop of Rome and his descendants. Therefore, Rome's bishop deserved the preeminence because that was the rock that Jesus built his church on, was there in Rome. And I think he probably drew from Irenaeus again, our little friend who was off a little bit. He had traced the founding of the Roman church to Peter and Paul. And that was totally wrong, and everybody was able to, later, in later centuries, they were able to show that that was not the case historically. It was an erroneous conclusion that he drew. I was just reading Romans just like a little while ago, because that's what we're doing in our women's Bible study, and I'm like, God, right from the beginning, Paul's talking about how he's heard about these believers, and he's like, you know, encouraged by their faith. It's like, obviously he didn't plant the church. He hadn't been there yet. So it's like, all they had to do is read the chapter 1 of Romans, and they would have figured out that Peter and Paul weren't there to plant the church. But whatever. Anyways, they instead went to the church father, Irenaeus, and they're like, oh, okay, he said the Roman church was founded by Peter and Paul. And so, yeah, again, unfortunately, that lent credence to this theory that, oh, okay, that must be the way it is. So the Petrine theory became a real solid argument for the Roman church. And it became a huge point of emphasis over the years as the power struggle between East and West continued. And again, I think this was a pretty obvious attempt to sound spiritual and not power hungry. Because a lot of times, I suppose we've all done this before on some level, people try to put a spiritual cloak on their fleshly motives and desires. You know, whether they say, like, the Lord told me this or that or whatever, you know. I mean, you know, how many times, well, sorry, you guys are, there's no girls in here. I was just going to say, how many times has a guy come up to you and said, the Lord told me we're supposed to be together? I'm like, okay, never mind. But, yeah, or have you done that ever too? Anyway. So, I mean, there are instances where, yeah, that's legitimately true, but there's sometimes where it's like, if you like someone, just ask them out. You don't have to say the Lord told you you're supposed to marry them. I mean, they'll freak a girl out. So, I mean, at least most of us, I don't know, that's freaked me out, but anyways. But all that to say, there are those times where we do something like that, where we just put some kind of a spiritual thing, even though we have a fleshly motive here. And really, I think that's what was going on. Damasus here, he wanted to make sure that Rome stayed predominant. That's really the bottom line. That's the ultimate motive. He wanted the church in Rome to have power and have authority. This was not about the glory of God. It was about the glory of the church in Rome, right? If it was about the glory of God, he probably would have been like, okay, whatever, we're going to just keep serving the Lord here and doing what we're called to do. We're not going to worry about what's going on in Constantinople, right? That probably would have been a better option here. But this is a scary position to be in. You know, what Damasus did was not... Yeah, not really a wise move, especially when you consider, you know, what the Apostle John said in 3 John 9 when he warned, you know, he rebuked those who like to have the preeminence among them. You know, that's something that's very unscriptural and scary position to be in. But unfortunately, because of this turn of events in 381, Rome did continue to grow in preeminence. For example, 20 years later, Pope Innocent I, he made a rule that no important decisions could be made in the Western Church without the consent of the Roman bishop. He wasn't called the Pope or anything. It was still just the Roman bishop. But he did make this statement, like, all major decisions need to go through Rome. So the Council of Constantinople was huge. In fact, Rome used the Petrine theory argument for centuries as a basis for their authority. And yet another reason for Rome's rise in importance, it was like a perfect storm of all of these things coming together in Rome's favor, honestly. But another reason for the church's rise in importance had to do with an invasion of Rome in 410, which you guys read about, by some barbarian invaders known as the Goths. Sometimes this invasion is actually marked as the end of the Roman Empire because it was the first time the city of Rome was actually invaded and breached. But Rome and the West, they continued to hold on for a little bit longer. As I mentioned last week, the line of emperors didn't officially end for another 60 years or so. So, it was still kind of limped along. But this attack by the Goths brought sympathy of the entire empire back to Rome. They're like, oh my gosh, the city of Rome got breached. I mean, everybody was like all concerned and worried about this. It was a really big boost to the Roman cause in a way to get everybody's focus back on them and off of Constantinople. So there's all this renewed concern and interest, and as time went on, it was further attacks on Rome that led to the emergence of the man who really elevated the church in Rome to dominance, religiously and politically, and then really solidified the power of the church over the state. And his name was Leo. He was the one who really brought it all to a head. Literally, he became the head. So he is the man who we say really defined the role of the Roman papacy. If you read some different historians, they might say that, oh, this guy was the first pope or this guy was the first pope. But I think Leo really is the one who kind of set the tone for that position. Your book says he provided for the first time the biblical theological bases of the papal claim. That is why it is misleading to speak of the papacy before his time. He was the one who really brought all the theology, supposed theology, together in support of a Roman pope. And so Leo, as you guys know, he was a proud, influential nobleman. He actually spoke out really strongly against heresy. So there were actually a few good things that Leo did. He teamed up with the empress in the Eastern Byzantine Empire. Her name was Pulcheria. She was actually the only female ruler of any part of the Roman Empire in history, so that's kind of interesting. And she was really cool. Like, she was solid, like, with the Lord. And they teamed up to root out false doctrine from the church. They especially tackled the teachings of Eutychus, who we'll talk about in a minute. So, in that way, Leo was a huge blessing to the church. He's actually considered a great defender of the faith for what he did in terms of fighting heresy. But Leo also liked power and liked control. And his ties to political power, I mean, you know, it just was just such a sign of where the church was at spiritually anyway, right? In this mixed marriage with the world. I mean, you could see that that mentality had already, unfortunately, poisoned the minds of a lot of church leaders like Leo. Like, oh, church and state. Yeah, we do this together. And in fact, I should probably take a little bit more of a role in politics. You know, so there's that whole mentality beginning to become more and more common within church leadership, unfortunately. And so he aggressively asserted Rome's influence based on the arguments of the Petrine theory, so he kind of built on what Damasus had said several years earlier. And he laid the foundation for what would exist in the church for centuries under the office or the title of the Papa or the Pope. That's where we get Pope from. We get it from Papa, which means father, right? So he's considered the father, the dad of the church. Of course, in Spanish, if you say it that way, it means potato. But anyway. So, las papas. All right. I should say papa. Yeah, I know. So, as he began to solidify the religious superiority of Rome's bishop as the pope, he began to exert his authority in other areas as well. He's like, why not flex my muscles in some other situations? And so, what happened was, again, like I said, it was a perfect storm during this time. The Western Empire is falling apart. Somebody needs to step in and take control. And it turned out that several emperors in the Western part of the empire were not strong at all. They were just weak. The whole, like I said, the whole infrastructure, everything was beginning to fall apart, come apart at the seams in the early 400s. And, oh my gosh, I was just reading a book this weekend about just how, like, violent and horrible the line of emperors were in the West. I mean, like, what was it out of? I can't remember. It was like out of 30-something emperors, only like less than 10 actually died a natural death. They were all like murdered or poisoned or committed suicide. I mean, they were just crazy. It was such a mess. And so that gave Leo the opportunity to, like I said, flex his muscles in the political world a little bit, not just in the spiritual world, or religious world, I should say. He actually began to step in and discipline government leaders. And in 445, he declared his supremacy as the leader of Christendom, of the Christian world. He said, as the primacy of the apostolic see is based on the title of the Blessed Peter, no illicit steps may be taken against this see to usurp its authority. So I've got a little bit of a dictator going on here. Like, no steps can be taken to try to take me down. You know, I mean, it's like, wow, this guy's, like, starting to kind of forget what it's all, you know, what he was supposed to be doing. As a servant of the people and, as a bishop, as a pastor, as a shepherd, you know, he's kind of forgetting his role here. So the leadership of Pope Leo culminated in the events of 452 when Attila the Hun attacked an already weak Western Empire. I point to it as if this is a photo. Here it is. This is what was going on. Obviously, it's just a painting, but anyway, there's Pope Leo there, and then where's Attila the Hun? I can't really tell. I think he's over here. I think that's him, like, on that horse. It's kind of a little clearer on my screen there. So as Attila marched on Rome, Leo went out to meet him, convinced him to withdraw his position. You guys know the story, and he did. He went ahead and, you know, left the city of Rome, basically intact. 3 years later, Leo intervened again when Gaiseric the Vandal marched on Rome. The Romans panicked. They murdered the emperor, and so Leo stepped in again, convinced Gaiseric to withdraw. He spent 2 weeks looting the city but left everybody alive. So even though the city was a big mess, the people survived, and therefore they looked to Leo as their hero, basically, because of the role he played in bringing peace when there was no political, you know, leadership going on. He was the one who stepped in and took care of business. So everything played right into his hands, basically. And so the Roman people were so thankful and proud of their papa, and that they eventually, that he eventually became known in history as Leo the Great. Only two other popes actually have that claim to fame.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Are the two people above the pope supposed to be Peter and Paul, angels?
Yeah, probably. Actually, I wouldn't say angels, though. Those look like how they usually depict the apostles. So, yeah, probably was supposed to be Peter and Paul.
They're saying that they, you know, built Rome.
Yeah, he's got their authority. Yeah, supposedly. That's a good point. Nice one. All right. So, Leo's leadership in these... I'm not sure where I got this quote. It's just a quote from a historian. Leo's leadership in these political crises helped begin the long process by which the Bishop of Rome became the most powerful Western figure in the Middle Ages, right? So, not just in terms of religion, right? He wasn't just the most powerful Western figure in the church. He became the most powerful Western figure politically as well. And so you see all these steps leading to the prominence, the preeminence, the authority of the church. And so, again, last week we saw how the government and the emperors contributed to the rise of the church, and now we see how the church itself, how the church empowered itself and became stronger and stronger. And this is all going to just set us up for the church's great rise to ruling over, all the land, the whole land, in the next several hundred years. So, with that, we're going to leave the rise of the church to discuss, because that brings us politically more or less to where we're going to launch out to, politically and religiously, to where we're going to launch into next week. But let's stop there with that and leave the rise of the church to discuss some other church issues, because even though some theology and doctrine had obviously been laid out in the 100s and the 200s in the early, early church, we talked about some of the church fathers that helped establish that, you know. Okay, there were still issues and heresies that were creeping into the church at this time. You know, we saw how the church combated Donatism, Docetism, and then what was the big one?
Gnosticism,
right? Okay, we saw the church combat some of those heresies and, like I said, lay a good, solid theological foundation, but there were still a lot of heresies coming into the church, and your book talks about those in quite a bit of detail, so I'm not going to get way into it. But I did want to at least highlight the four major church councils. And these are in your book, but we're gonna look at those really briefly here. And remember this, and I've said this I think before: theology is very helpful and great, but it's not as good as the Bible itself. And I think that's kind of where we start seeing a shift and people starting to wander off a little bit at this point. And I think this is why the church veered away over time and got so far off the mark, was because they began to focus more and more on what the early church fathers had said and the church councils before them had said, not so much on what the Bible itself said. So they were like, well, if we want theology, we'll just go to what the church fathers said, because they're the ones who studied the Bible and they know. It's like, well, that's great, but you're getting like a regurgitated secondhand version instead of hearing from God himself. So it's just not quite the same, even though there is, you know, some solid church fathers and all. It could easily lead you astray the more you start looking at man. And so first of these four councils, I should say, in a nutshell, the majority of the issues in the next couple centuries, the 300s and the 400s, centered on Christology, right? The study of Jesus Christ, basically, and who he was. That's what the major heresies and arguments were about, right? I mean, we talked about some of the other ones. You've read about some of the other issues. But this was the major point of attack by heretics during the 300s and 400s. And so heretics like Arius, I'll get to him in a second. Is he on there? Yeah, there, Arius. Okay, Arius asserted that Jesus was a created being, and therefore there was a time when the Son was not. You guys read that that was like his little jingle, okay? It was almost like one of those commercials that you hear like playing over and over and that won't get out of your head. That was the little jingle that was even sung by little kids all over town. They probably had no idea what they were singing, but there was a time when the Son was not. In other words, there was a time when Jesus did not exist. He was created. And so that became a very popular heresy, but it led to the calling of, one good thing about it was that it led to the calling of a church council, the Council of Nicaea, which was a very significant one. And that was in 325 AD, okay? The Council of Nicaea in 325. That one was presided over by Constantine. So we're going way back here to when Constantine was first changing things up in terms of the church and the state. All right, so the Council of Nicaea. A lot of things were established at the Council of Nicaea. That was one major thing that happened, was removing Arius and his influence. Later, a guy named Apollinarius came along, and he contended that Jesus was basically God inhabiting a body, but not bearing any... Bless you. Not bearing any real human qualities. Like, basically like possession, I guess, of some sort. You know, it's kind of weird, like a zombie kind of a thing. It's like, okay, he doesn't really have any human... You know, there's nothing going on there, but he's just this body walking around, kind of weird. Okay, so Apollinarius and his heresy was taken care of in 381 at the Council of Constantinople. Again, that's the same council that we were just talking about, where Damasus brought in the Petrine theory. A lot of things happened at these church councils, so I'm not going to get into all the details, but, you know, just to simplify, these were some of the main issues. So Apollinarius was dealt with at that council. After that, a bishop named Nestorius declared that Jesus had two natures. Here, I'll put him down there. Nestorius. Jesus had two natures, right? Which was like, okay, yes, he was fully God and fully man. But he said the divine, the God part of him, was not present during his birth, his suffering, or his crucifixion. In other words, every time Jesus went through something gnarly, some nitty-gritty, very human kind of event, his divine nature basically just took a vacation. Like, okay, I'm going to peace out now. I'll come back later when you're done suffering. You know, it's kind of a weird, okay, so anything gnarly Jesus went through, that was when his divine nature took off. Kind of strange. That heresy was taken care of at the Council of Ephesus in 431. This was actually one of the councils that Leo and Pulcheria were very involved in, and they actually tackled that heresy. That was one that they battled against. So, like I said, Leo did have a couple good points, surprisingly. Finally, though, there was the heresy of Eutychus. This was the last... Oh, sorry. Council of Ephesus was in 431. Council of Chalcedon. Okay, so the heresy of Eutychus was basically stated that Jesus had only one nature. And so... What happened was Jesus' human nature was essentially swallowed up by his divine nature. Now, that should actually kind of sound familiar, because that was a repackaging of some of the Gnostic concepts, that matter was evil. That's where Eutychus was kind of coming from. He's thinking, well, matter is evil, therefore we'll just have to assume that Jesus' divine nature kind of swallowed up the human one, so it wasn't really there, because God wouldn't come and be in a physical body as a full-on man. I mean, that's too much to take in. And so, again, here's the church having to deal with a repackaging of Gnosticism yet again. And like I said already, Pulcheria and Leo also fought against this teaching. This was actually the main one that they really tackled and dealt with. And it was stamped out at the Council of Chalcedon in 451. Okay, so... these four councils were really essential in helping to just really solidify what we believe now, and what the Bible teaches, that Jesus was indeed fully God and fully man, right? So, praise the Lord, in the midst of, you know, false doctrines, and even in the middle of, like, the church becoming more power-hungry and starting to lose their perspective, we see the church leadership becoming more and more corrupt. In the middle of that, there were still those who, just like Jesus commended in the Church of Pergamos, they held fast to his name and did not deny the faith. There's always a remnant. There are always those that stay true. Thank God. And so the neat thing is, as with the early church era, during this era, the era of Constantine and following, there were still some church fathers who emerged to defend truth and defend purity. So what I did a couple weeks ago, I want to just list these guys for you. And again, remember, like, some of these guys, most of them were awesome and right on, just like the early church fathers. It's just that future generations kept building on them and not building on the scriptures, right? They would just go back to the church fathers because they were such great guys and be like, well, this is what they said. I guess we believe it. You know, like I said, Irenaeus probably, without even realizing it, like, led everyone astray and as they developed the Petrine theory. So it's kind of unfortunate that that's what happened when these guys were, you know, right on. So keep in mind, too, that by this time we have a distinctly Eastern church leadership and Western church leadership. So let's do the Eastern church fathers first, starting with John Chrysostom. We could even throw in John of Damascus, who we talked about last week with the icons and all that stuff. You could put him, lump him in there if you wanted to, but what? His head?
Yeah.
I know, we got a real brainy guy here. That's probably what they were trying to depict. All the really smart guys have huge heads. I don't know. Maybe not. So John Chrysostom, he's like super significant in the Eastern Church. One of the divine liturgies, like the order of services that they use in the Eastern Orthodox Church, is called the Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. So I don't know. That's like the main one they use for most services. So he's very well known, very prominent in the Eastern Church. One of the church's first great preachers, because he was most known for the way he powerfully exposited the scriptures. And so he was really solid in that way. His preaching was considered the best in his day. In fact, that's what the name Chrysostomos means. It means golden mouth. That's where he got the name, was because he was such a great orator, a great preacher. Golden mouth. How about that? Yeah, anyways. So John was born in Antioch. He entered a monastery, but he was so severe in his self-discipline, his asceticism, that he actually damaged his health permanently, and they kicked him out to go back out into the world and try to get better again. It's like, you're like way overdoing this. You need to go and eat food and sleep on a bed and stuff. So anyways, he became a priest in the church in Antioch, and at this time he wrote a book called On the Priesthood, which was a look at some of the pitfalls in ministry. And it's a pretty mature perspective that he had. I thought he made some really good points. He said, "I do not know whether anyone has ever succeeded in not enjoying praise. And if he enjoys it, naturally he wants to receive it. And if he wants to receive it, he cannot help being pained and distraught when he loses it." It's like, that is so true, though. He just made some really good observations of human nature and how even leaders needed to be very careful about that sort of thing. I think a lot of people probably should have read his book. At the time, you know, guys like Leo, that probably would have been a good thing. So it was while he was pastoring in Antioch that John became most well-known for his preaching. He spoke out, and he was a pretty bold guy. It wasn't like he said a lot of really pretty, like, you know, soft things. I mean, he dealt with hard issues. I mean, he really tackled sin, impurity in the church. He denounced abortion, prostitution, gluttony, swearing, going to the theater even, all those kinds of things he really, you know, tackled. And again, that's not just like major obvious ones like prostitution, but even like gluttony, things that, you know, people normally wouldn't, you know, like gossip, things that we kind of let slide all the time. I mean, he really like addressed sin in a strong way. And yet, even though he was very straightforward and kind of abrasive, his reputation just totally soared. And, you know, I think that's just because sometimes people do want to hear it, right? You know, you want to hear it straight. You want somebody to be honest. You know, really, it's kind of refreshing when somebody's just honest. And I think that's why he became so popular. And maybe even a novelty in that day. So in 398, what happened was he basically was kidnapped and forced to become the Archbishop of Constantinople. Kind of weird. Anyways, the government basically wanted the capital city of the East to have the best speaker in Christendom. They're like, oh yeah, the West thinks they're so cool. We're going to take you and make you our archbishop. It's like, hey, so silly. Anyways, all these little power plays and stuff. Really dumb reasoning, but John, for whatever reason, he accepted it as the will of God. I'm like, okay. I mean, really, does he have a choice? He's under arrest. It's like, okay, fine, I'll be your archbishop. Whoa. But the great thing was his new position, and now the fact that he has this new prestigious audience. I mean, he's got royalty there coming, and, you know, all of these imposing important figures attending his church services. Even though he had a total change of venue and change of audience, he did not change his message. He continued to preach the same bold messages against sin. He was a man of conviction. He was a man of integrity. And so he refused to compromise the truth based on who he was speaking to. And so he began to speak against the abuse of wealth and the abuse of power. You know, those are kind of things that are going to start rubbing some people the wrong way there in the capital city. And even though, this is cool too, even though he was given like a real nice salary, you know, he had real posh, you know, living conditions and all that kind of thing, he was provided for very well financially for his position, but he continued to live as an ascetic, live in simplicity. You know, he would take a lot of his salary and the money that people that they would give him and use it for the poor. He would just turn around and give it away. I mean, he really practiced what he preached. He really lived it out. Like I said, he lived as simple of a lifestyle as he could. He never let the wealth and the soft life, the comfy life, go to his head and affect him. And so wherever he was, his focus was on reaching out to the unsaved, and he really lived for that end. He said, there would be no more heathen if we would be true Christians. It's like, oh, that's an interesting point. There would be no more heathen if we would be true Christians. It's like, hey, if we really lived this out, you know. I mean, and he did. He, like I said, he really practiced what he preached, and I think he was just a walking conviction to everyone around him. And so eventually he made so many enemies because of his stand for the truth that he was sent off into exile, where he ended up dying. Years later, though, he was formally restored. He was given the title Doctor of the Church. And I think his testimony reminds me of 1 John 2 when it says, he who does the will of God abides forever. Because you see, his testimony has remained. You know, and like I said, even in the liturgy, the church services in the East are still called by his name to this day. Even what his enemies conspired, despite what his enemies conspired against him, his reputation remains. And I think he's just a real admirable guy. Really like that guy. Then we have Theodore. Oh, whoops, sorry, I don't have a picture of Theodore. I don't have a lot to say about him anyway, but that's okay. But he was significant. I just don't have a lot of information on him. He lived from 350 to, well, actually, nobody knows when he died, but he was born in the year 350. He was the bishop of Cilicia starting in 392, and he was important because Origen, as you might recall, he had developed this allegorical system of interpreting the Bible, you know, turning everything into a symbol and into an allegory, and it got a little bit weird. And so he opposed that system, and Theodore said, no, we don't want to look at everything allegorically. You need to understand the history, the background, the context, the grammar of what the Bible is saying. Like, let's take it more literally as saying what it means, not meaning all of these other weird things. So he was, you know, more of a literal kind of a guy. And this was very, very important. A very, very important emphasis in, you know, bringing about proper biblical interpretation once again. So he was a really key figure in kind of getting the church off of Origen's allegorical system. You know, that still pervaded, as we'll see, throughout the Middle Ages, but Theodore was a good voice in bringing Bible interpretation back to where we would do it today, right? That's what we do. You look at the context, you look at the language, the grammar, and the, you know, background and all that stuff. That's important. Theodore's only big problem was that he tended to side with the views of Nestorius, one of our condemned heretics that we just looked at. Whoops! So he kind of had a, you know, strange view there of the nature of Christ, which is weird if he was supposed to be all about looking at the Bible literally and everything, but anyway, you know, and it, you know, some of these guys, they might have gone off on something for a little while and then repented and gotten back on track again. I mean, these things happen. So then we have Eusebius. Now, he's very important for this class because most of the early church history that we've talked about in the first couple weeks of class came from him. He's the one who compiled a lot of the information we have from the first couple centuries of the church. Because in those first few centuries, nobody had ever really tried to compile a history. There were no collections of key documents. There were no chronologies, hardly anything, you know, it was just like a document here and there scattered all over the place in all of the churches. They all had, you know, a little bit of, you know, maybe an account of a martyrdom over here or a biography of this church father over here. It was all scattered all over the place. And again, why would they be sitting around compiling a history when they're all being persecuted and running for their lives? You know, nobody had time to sit around and, oh, I think I'll write a book. You know, I mean, it was like totally not an option during the first couple of centuries. But that was the task that Eusebius decided to undertake. And this was a massive undertaking. Like I said, because there were... It's not like he had a bunch of points of reference. I mean, he was the point of reference. He had to bring it all together for the first time and try to piece everything together in a chronology. So as the Bishop of Caesarea, that's what he really felt that the Lord called him to do. And really, it's because of his massive contribution in documenting early church history that he is known as the father of church history. But interestingly, it was said he did not want to just record the facts. Quote, he wanted to show that Christianity with Constantine's conversion was the pinnacle of humanity's long climb. And again, that was a big thing with the Eastern Church, right? We talked about this last week. They really viewed Constantine as their poster child, as their hero. And the West was appreciative of him as well, of course, but in the East, he was just like, oh, revered, right? And so for that reason, and I mentioned this last week about Eusebius, he was ecstatic with Constantine's leadership and reign. Especially because if you look at his lifespan, he survived survived Terminalia, that last persecution of the church under Diocletian, the really horrific one that, you know, was the persecution to end all persecutions. He survived that. And so you can imagine, of course he was stoked on Constantine. Of course he thought this guy was the man of the hour. He even wrote a book called Life of Constantine. So, you know, like I said, he was Constantine's biggest fan. But, you know, he also was a godly man. And, you know, he hated controversy. He hated all the doctrinal conflict within the church. However, he was known for developing the Caesarean Creed, which was modified into the famous Nicene Creed, which is in your book and which you might have even heard before, right? I believe in God the Father, maker of heaven and earth, Jesus Christ, his only son, right? All of those kind of things. He had documented, or I guess you'd say articulated in the Caesarean Creed. And then, like I said, they adapted that. So that's, you know, pretty much all that we said about Eusebius. We don't really know much about his personal life other than what his writings reveal, and so that's the basics on him. But he was a very important person.
Wait, so what was the Caesarean Creed?
The Caesarean Creed that he wrote was developed into the Nicene Creed. That's what they used when they went to put together the Nicene.
The Council of Nicaea, they basically took whatever...
They took what Eusebius said. They were like, you know, this is pretty good. And they kind of, modified and adapted it into the... Yes, so the Council of Nicaea, yeah, that's what they did. They took it and modified it and used it. So, make sense? Okay. So then we have... Let's see. We'll do Athanasius and then we'll take a break. So then we have this guy, Athanasius... And this guy really had it rough. You guys read about him in your book. He was one of the main voices that spoke out against that really pesky heresy called Arianism, the one that said there was a time when the sun was not. Like I said, that was probably out of all the heretics during during the 300s and 400s, I think Arianism was probably the most difficult one to root out. Kind of like Gnosticism in the earlier centuries, in the 100s and the 200s. You know, this was just like another one of those that was, for whatever reason, a very popular heresy. And yet, guys like Athanasius, the Lord raised them up because they could see the dangers of a false teaching like this. Like, okay, that might sound okay, that Jesus was a created being. He's like, but that's not what the Bible teaches. It's not true. And so... he was able to very effectively fight against it, and as I said before, there was a council held. The Council of Nicaea refuted Arius and his teachings, but only a couple months later, followers of Arius were able to get him reinstated again by Constantine. Constantine's an emperor. He doesn't know all the, you know, he wasn't probably very well-versed in the theology and of the Christian faith. He's like, well, okay, let that guy back in. I mean, it's like, oh, great. You know, he just undid all that work, and so... Athanasius refused to admit him back into the church. He took a stand. He said, no, I don't care what the emperor said. This isn't right. And so his enemies spread rumors about him. They got Athanasius banished. And that actually happened to him 5 times. On 5 different occasions, he got banished from it. It's like, oh my gosh, just leave him in exile already, all right? Don't keep bringing him back, reinstating him, and then pulling him out again. My goodness. But most of the time, that happened for, you know, political, not just theological reasons. There were a lot of other weird things going on that led to his banishment repeatedly. But as we saw with John Chrysostom, that didn't leave him, Athanasius, from leaving his permanent mark on Christian history. For one thing, he wrote a biography called The Life of St. Anthony, which I put over there, about an ascetic hermit who lived out in the desert, like you guys read about. This book and the example of Anthony's life really inspired and helped shape the concept of monasticism. And again, your book gets into all of that, but a lot of that was triggered, a lot of the popularity of monasticism was triggered by his book, The Life of St. Anthony. So it actually, you know, this was, it didn't just influence people that became monks at that time. I mean, it eventually helped, you know, inspire a lot of other people. It even was an influence in leading Augustine to Christ. So it had a long, long-lasting impact. Not only that, but Athanasius developed a list of the canonical books of Scripture, which ended up being the one that we use, right, to this day. We use the list that Athanasius developed of the canonical books of Scripture. So he made a lot of really significant contributions. Like I said, like John Chrysostom, I think it was his godly stand for truth that made his work so lasting, that made his impact endure, right? Again, he who does the will of God abides forever. And you see that, you know, with these guys and their testimonies. Even if during their lifetime they were under attack, their faithfulness and their, you know, integrity and walk with the Lord remained in spite of that. So let's go ahead and take a break now. And then, yeah, we'll knock this out. This is going to go fast tonight, my goodness.
You said he developed the books, the canon?
Gotcha there.
Put the help of Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Okay. So that brings us. Actually, that doesn't bring us anywhere. And that was kind of a bad segue. Anyways, that was a dead end. So moving on. That's the Eastern Church Fathers we looked at, right, before the break. And now let's look at some of the Western Church Fathers, like this guy, Jerome.
Jerome.
Very significant guy. That was enthusiastic.
Jerome.
Okay.
Doing his nails or something?
What? Doing his nails? Oh, yeah.
Oh,
he's getting the line of manicure in that picture. No, he is... There's like this whole legend about him removing a thorn from the paw of a lion and all that stuff. Yeah, I don't remember the story. He was after the persecutions, so I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure. I can't remember the story. I'll have to look that one up and get the full, you know. You've heard it before, right? Okay. Yeah. Children's story. Yeah, something like that.
Years.
Yeah, whatever, you know, it's all a wash, who knows, I mean, I'm just kidding. All right, no, every year is important. So, right, Jerome is considered one of the four great church fathers in history. There's like, I don't know, the big four in the, I guess you'd say the final four, huh? If we want to go college basketball here, but there were four main main church fathers in the Western Church that were real significant, and one of them was Jerome. He's also probably the greatest Bible translator. He was drawn to an ascetic lifestyle, the life of, you know, the monasteries and being a monk. He actually did go out and spend some time in the deserts of Israel, but it just didn't satisfy him. It didn't do anything for him like it did maybe for Antony or some of these other guys. But he did learn Hebrew while he was in Israel, so that would come in handy later, as we'll see. By this time, you know, he's probably what? He's like in his 20s, 30s here. He was considered, had become known as a pretty good, pretty able scholar and monk. And so some people wanted him to ordain him as a priest, but he wanted to continue on with his studies. And so he just kind of stayed in a monastery and just kind of carried on doing his thing. In 382, he was summoned to Rome. He was actually told, no, you need to, you know, come here. They didn't just suggest at this time. They brought him over to be part of the church leadership there. But he rubbed the Romans the wrong way. He was very sharp in the way he criticized their ways, their ignorance of the scriptures. And my gosh, I always do this. I have a book that has a bunch of quotes from him in it, and I always mean to bring it to class, and then I forget. Even today I was like, don't forget to do that, and I did. So, man, I don't know. I must be just getting old or something.
So.
Oh, what a tease, I know. I'm sure this is going to, like, we're going to toss and turn all night. I wonder what it was. Anyways, maybe that's another thing I could try to remember for next week. The lion story and the book. Anyways, eventually, I mean, because he actually had some really funny quotes. Like, he's pretty sarcastic and witty guy. So eventually, though, he went back to the Holy Land and settled in Bethlehem, where he finished translating the Bible into a Latin version known as the Vulgate. The Latin Vulgate. He actually had help from two really neat ladies named Marcella and Paula. Paula was one of his like besties, so they were real tight. And so I have to give a little shout out to the ladies because they really did a lot to help out with the translation here, even though they don't get a lot of credit for it. So all previous translations before Jerome's time, you know, whenever they tried to translate the Bible into any of the other languages, it wasn't really necessary because, you know, Latin was the main language of the empire and remained so for a while. And prior to that, it was Greek, and we've talked about that already. So there's like Greek, Latin, and stuff like that. But anytime somebody tried to do any translation from the original Greek, Hebrew, or Aramaic, there had always been kind of inaccurate translations, inferior translations, just done by people that didn't really have a full grasp of the language and stuff like that. And so they were just kind of Mickey Mouse thrown together. And so Jerome saw these translations into Latin, and he's like, man, I want to do one that's like legit, that doesn't just copy other people who copied other people. I'm going to go back to the original Hebrew, the original Greek of the Bible, and I'm going to, you know, make sure that my translation is as accurate as possible. And because he knew Hebrew, he could do that. He was a Hebrew scholar, yes.
At this point, was the Bible already like what we have, like Genesis or Revelation?
Yes, it would have been by this time, because that was in the canon. I think that was in one of the, what?
Was it just the Old Testament, or is it Old and New Testament?
Yeah, by this time? Yeah, for sure.
So he
had all the scriptures.
All of it.
Yes, he did the entire Bible.
And this one, the Vulgate was just the Old Testament.
No, as far as I know, it's the whole thing. Okay. So, yeah.
At this point, so they already weeded out like all those extra books then.
The Apocrypha, you know, what ended up in the Catholic Bible later. But yeah, there were some people that still obviously would use those. But the church...
Of those 100 or some scholars that got together to figure out what books they were, or were they just like a group?
No, he just didn't like what was out there and decided to...
He didn't like the translations. He wasn't questioning which books belonged in the canon. He just didn't like the translations that had been done because he was like, that's not really a very good, you know, again, because he had learned Hebrew being over in Israel and everything, he's like, you know, he could look at some of these translations and see that they were just, like I said, Mickey Mouse, kind of halfway done, not done properly. And so this was actually, for us, that's like, okay, that's an obvious no-brainer. Like, yes, we're going to go to the original languages to translate, because that's what we do today. But back then, this was a totally novel idea, and that's what set the standard for future translators, to go back to the original language. So that's why Jerome is kind of considered the father of Bible translation, because he set that standard and a pattern for other translators in the future. The Vulgate was so important that it actually became the official text of the church for the next 1,000 years, basically, which is pretty remarkable. In fact, the Vulgate was the main text of the Catholic Church into the 1960s. That's pretty crazy. So I know, yeah, they were still, you know, had the Mass in Latin and were using the Vulgate. So that is really incredible, right, if you think about it.
What year was it?
So he wrote this in late 300s, early 400s. So towards the end of his life, he finished it. I'm trying to remember, when was the Vulgate? Was it four?
No, when did the Catholic Church use it?
Oh, sorry, until the 1960s.
Oh, okay.
Oh, gosh, I have the date for the Vulgate. It's somewhere in my memory bank somewhere. Sorry, but anyway.
So the Catholics at that time didn't know anything except for what they taught them. Because most people didn't speak Latin.
No, at this time they did. During Jerome's time, they still did. This is still early. Like, the Roman Empire hasn't completely fallen apart yet during his lifetime. So, yeah, we're just going through some of the key figures. So I gave you guys the history, the chronology at the beginning of class. Now we're just going back over some of the key people during that time. So he was still alive during the early centuries when Latin was very common. And that was actually why he translated it into Latin, why he wanted a good, accurate copy of the Latin Bible, because everybody was still speaking Latin around the empire, right? And that was his heart, was that the Bible be translated into the language of the people. We're going to talk about this later, but I guess I'll just mention it now. Vulgate, that term, you know, there's a word we have in English that comes from that, which would be
vulgar.
Now, to us nowadays, that'd be like if I, like, you know, if one of you guys, like, belched the alphabet in class, that would be kind of vulgar, like, ew, kind of crude, right? That's what we usually think of as vulgar. But the original meaning of the word vulgar is common. It just means common or everyday. And so that was the reason why we called it the Latin Vulgate, because he wanted it to be in the common language of the people. The everyday that people could read. That was his whole heart, was that the Bible, you know, be for the people. Sadly, however, even though this was a monumental feat, it was used in the church for centuries, as time went on, Latin was no longer spoken or read. As we're going to see, Latin fell by the wayside and became a dead language, right? After the Roman Empire fell apart and everything. And only the people, only the clergy, only the well-educated people in the church or sometimes in the government would even be able to read Latin as time went on. And so that meant the common people would not have it in their language, in their own language anymore. As we're going to see, that caused a lot of problems. But Jerome's original intention, you know, if only the church would have really, you know, for all their claim that they were following the church fathers, that they would have done what Jerome had done, they would have realized, gosh, he wanted this to be in the language of the people.
Sounds similar to William Tyndale's.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. We'll definitely see that later on, too. So, yeah, Jerome once said, make the knowledge of the scriptures your love. Live with them, meditate on them, make them the sole object of your knowledge and inquiries. So, I mean, guy with a real heart for the Lord, a real heart for the Word of God. So, a really good man that God used. And then we have Ambrose. Ambrose was an interesting fella. Like Jerome, he got a cone head there on the right, but like Jerome, he is considered one of the four great father, church fathers of this era. So we have Jerome and Ambrose, two of our four big guys. Not only that, but Ambrose is the first Latin church father, Western church father from a Christian family, interestingly. He actually began his career in politics, not the church, but everybody in the church really liked him. And so what happened was when the Bishop of Milan died in Italy, he was shocked to find out that everybody wanted him to become the next bishop. They're like, you know, you're such a, you know, good leader, you're a godly man, why don't you take this position? So he didn't actually want to get into church leadership, but like John Chrysostom and some of these other guys, he got placed under arrest until he agreed to do it. So this is weird, you know, this is what church-state relations will do, you know, you can arrest people until they take a position in the church. It's like, not exactly how people want to receive their call into ministry, I don't think, so... It makes for an interesting testimony. But anyway, during that time, she was like, okay, whoa, you win. The Arian controversy was at its peak, but Ambrose was one of those voices that spoke out against Arianism to help refute it with strong orthodoxy. And so he was really instrumental in helping bring down the Arian doctrine once and for all. Poor Athanasius, you know, I mean, he just got a bum rap through the whole thing. But Ambrose was able to finally put some nails in the coffin there. Ambrose also is known for introducing congregational singing to the church. So that's kind of cool, you know, getting everybody going with all that. I think that was already going on to some degree, but he was really well known for doing that. He is known as the father of hymnody, of hymns, because he wrote a lot of hymns in his church, and that was something that was kind of new in that era. And so he was a great administrator, leader, preacher. In fact, that old saying, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. You guys have heard that before? Maybe? Yeah, okay. No? Well, now you have. Ambrose said that. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. It's like a, you know, it's been a saying that's obviously been around forever. So that came from one of his sermons. But he is probably most known for what he did in the area of church-state relations. One biographer said he wrestled with three emperors and he won every time. In fact, Ambrose is the guy I was talking about earlier, the bishop who caused Theodosius to back down after the riot. Remember, he's the one who told Theodosius he needed to repent publicly and all that. That was Ambrose. So that was the first time that the church kind of, I guess you could say, defeated the state or got a leg up on the state. And Ambrose, you know, he took it from there. Again, he was able to, you know, exert his influence over two emperors after Theodosius. And so he was the one who really introduced, quote, the concept of a Christian emperor as the dutiful son of the church serving under orders from Christ. That became kind of a concept that, pervaded throughout the Middle Ages, that idea, like, oh, the Christian emperor is kind of serving under orders from Christ, therefore the church should have the prominent role. Because, you know, we're supposed to be, you know, serving together in society, but if we're serving God, then the spiritual things need to be more prominent. So that was kind of the mentality that was going to continue to be developed. And as we saw, Leo built on that foundation, extending that primarily to the Bishop of Rome, and it continued on from there to become the ultimate power struggle of the Middle Ages, as we'll see next week, you know, trying to decide who's the boss, church or state. You know, there's this that constant struggle in this unhealthy marriage that we got going on here. So obviously Ambrose was a very important guy. The only student of his to outshine him was none other than Augustine.
Where are you going?
And so, there's your man right there. Okay. I'm not going to talk too much about him because your book already did that enough. Obviously, you guys read a whole chapter about him. He was born in North Africa, eventually returned there, and he's the third of our four great church fathers that we're going to look at. The fourth one won't be till next week. I'm going to leave you hanging in suspense. Oh, my gosh. I don't even know if you can stand it. Okay. I'm so sorry.
Wait. We have to know.
Yeah.
Read the book.
What?
Read the book.
Yep. You'll find out. But Augustine's probably the most, I mean, I don't even want to say he's better than all the other guys, but he's the most greatest in terms of his influence. The greatest of all of these church fathers is Augustine. Because he laid a theological foundation in his writings and in his teachings that made him really considered the architect of the Middle Ages. He's the one who laid that theological foundation and groundwork that would last for centuries. His book, City of God, is kind of his masterpiece in terms of theology. But all of his works in general are considered prized possessions and documents of the early church, of church history. What?
It seemed like he didn't back them like everybody else. Everybody else started going some way and they all recanted and said, oh, no, this one. He seemed like he was always on the right track.
Yeah, he was pretty solid. I mean, after living such a pagan, crazy life, I think he was just like, I'm going to stay as close to the Lord as possible. So, yeah. He was a good guy, and you know, like his the Confessions of St. Augustine, that's another really important book in church history. So these are all, you know, again, really, really key things that he contributed. But I do, like I said, I'm not going to say much about him, but I do want to talk about his conversion because it's not in your book. And a lot of it had to do with, and I'm going to throw out another, give a shout out here to another woman behind the scenes, right? Like Marcella and Paula were for Jerome. Or Pulcheria, that empress there. There's these every now and then. There's a gal who's doing some work behind the scenes, and that woman was his mother, Monica. His mother, Monica, was a Christian woman, godly woman, and she prayed for her son Augustine for years, all the way through his school years, and then his wild and crazy life as a young man. She actually kicked him out of the house at one point because he was just so out there and ungodly and all that sort of thing. But, you know, she never stopped praying for him the entire time. She just, showed that tough love a little bit. But she figured, his dad was a total pagan, and I prayed and, just brought him to the Lord consistently, and he got saved. Augustine's dad had gotten saved, and so she figured, man, if I just continue to pray and be a godly example, God might save my son as well. And so she just persevered, praying for him, loving him, even when, she had to be firm. And so, as an adult, when he decided to move to Rome, Monica wanted to go with him. But as the story goes, as they were preparing to board the ship and sail off, Augustine pretended that he had to go say goodbye to some friends. He pretended that in the crowd of all the people there at the dock, he's like, oh, I see some friends over there, Mom. Stay right here and wait for me, and I'll be right back. I've just got to go talk to these people. So she's waiting on the dock. The crowd starts thinning out and clearing. Everybody's boarding the ship. The ship sails, and she's just thinking, oh, no, he went away, and, he missed the ship. Well, little did she know that he had snuck onto the ship when she was waiting down there. He didn't see any friends. He just, ran off, got on the ship, and sailed off without her, because obviously he didn't want this Christian ball and chain dragging behind him. He didn't want his mom hanging around with him. So, he snuck off. I was like, what a jerk. He leaves his mom standing on the dock for hours wondering where he is. But she was rad. I love this lady because, remember, she knew how to persevere, with praying for her son and loving and caring for him. She was kind of a dog with a bone. And so she really didn't take a hint, that he didn't want her there. And she's like, oh, well, I guess I'll just get on the next boat, silly boy. He forgot his mom here on the dock. Anyway, so she gets on the next boat and catches up with him. And she basically, she didn't live with him or anything. She just decided to live in Rome where he was. And so she basically just picked up a new life, started a home Bible study, I think, a bunch of other stuff. She was just this really cool lady, just, living a fruitful life where she was. But she was just kind of a presence there, always praying for him and continuing to just believe her son would come to Christ. And sure enough, under the teaching of Ambrose, and after so many seeds had been planted in his life, like I said, the example of life of St. Anthony, all of these different little things, and you guys read in the book how, he heard those little children saying, take up and read, and then he picked up the Bible, and the Word just, so all of these things combined together, all of these seeds planted in his life, I think a lot of it had, you know, a lot of them were planted because of her prayers. You know, the Lord just kept working and working on his heart. Finally, he came to Christ. Soon after this, Monica actually died. She and Augustine were on a ship going somewhere. She died in the port of Ostia, but not before seeing her son come to salvation and get baptized. And so, honestly, that was probably the one thing she wanted more than anything else before she died. And so to be able to see that, that was enough for her. That was her great joy. And so, of course, he went on from there to become one of the greatest men in church history. So I think, and the reason I tell that story, I think, is because it's such a huge lesson in the power of prayer. And, you know, really the importance of praying without ceasing, or, you know, like Luke 18 says, men ought always to pray and not lose heart, because we see the results. You know, we never know if somebody we're praying for might end up becoming someone that the Lord uses in a powerful way. You know, it's happened not just with Monica and Augustine, but it's happened throughout history over and over again, where God answered the prayers of a godly mom, a godly grandma, a godly grandpa, or father, or whoever, or friend. There we go. So, you know, God, there's always, he works so much through prayer. And so I've always been so encouraged by that story. It reminds me and encourages me to keep praying and not lose heart for different people in my life that seem so far gone. Because you guys read in the book, Augustine was way out there. I mean, he was just like given over to sin and, you know, immorality, sexual morality, all that stuff. I mean, he was kind of a mess. And yet, you know, he was not too far gone for the Lord. So I just love that story and that and the example of his mom there. So, wow, we are like cruising along here. As we've seen so far, the era of Constantine, again, we're going to kind of, just to recap here, I like to reiterate and recap so we definitely are continuing to stay on the same page, because there's so much information and so much covered. So this whole era, the era of Constantine, radically changed, as we saw, the face of the empire and the church. Not only did the empire now officially accept the church was rising to power to the point of equality and even superiority to the state. But the marriage of religion and politics, as we've seen, also came at a price, because it meant that anything that happened in the empire automatically affected the church. And so the division of the empire into East and West divided the church as well. So we've got division going on all sides, right? Within the church, within the empire, there's division, separation, internal weakness. We start to see that happen, especially in the West, as the emperors were so inept over the last century or so. Well, maybe even longer than that, of the Roman Empire. We see totally inept and corrupted leadership to the point where everything came apart at the seams. And so it wasn't simply the division of the empire and the church that was taking place from within. There wasn't just a lot of internal conflict going on within the church and state. There was also division, also conflict from without, from outside. And that came in the form of those barbarian invaders that I mentioned before, groups like the Goths. The Huns, different ones that came in, the Vandals, and began to not only invade the city of Rome, but try to take over parts of the empire. So the barbarians, what they were basically various groups of warriors. They were actually a whole bunch of different tribes and totally different people groups. From the north primarily, like Scandinavia, Iceland, they were coming down from the north, and also from the east. And they were just given the general, even though they were totally different people groups, they were given the general name barbarian by the Romans, because the Romans thought their language and their manner was very crude and very vulgar, because they didn't speak Latin and they didn't, you know, obviously they weren't educated in the same way that the Romans would have been under the Greco-Roman culture and all that kind of thing. And so they were considered barbarous, basically, and vulgar. But, you know, these guys did have civilization of some sort. They did have, you know, language and culture. It was just completely different from what Rome knew. And they weren't, you know, sometimes you get the perspective, I guess, that the barbarians were just total idiots, you know, or just like cavemen out there. We won't kill you, you know, not even know how to talk, right, and stuff like that. It's like, they weren't, maybe there was some level, like a lack of education, but they weren't like total morons. I mean, especially when it came to warfare. Yes.
Let's talk about Germans being barbarians.
Yeah, those were. Yeah, the Germans was a group. All of those were different. The Germanics, yeah, they were all barbarian tribes. Like I said, the Romans just called them all the same thing, because they just looked down on them as just like idiots and stuff. So, yes.
I read somewhere that they called them barbarians because they thought that that's like, it was like a, how they thought the...
How they heard their voice, bar, bar. Yeah, that's how they heard it. It sounded like gibberish. Exactly. So that's, I mean, that's where the term...
Basically, anyone who didn't speak Latin.
Yeah, was a barbarian. Yeah, pretty much, yeah, you were not civilized. And so, yeah, that's exactly, because that's where the term actually comes from, is from barbar, so that would be, yeah, just a nonsensical kind of a thing. But like I said, when it came to warfare, these guys, man, the Romans completely underestimated them, I would say. As early as the 300s and 400s, they were already starting to wreak havoc on the fringes of the Roman Empire. That was the one reason why Diocletian wanted to, you know, subdivide the empire. That's why Constantine felt like there needed to be a stronger presence in the east, why he founded Constantinople. Because he could see, we're having these groups attacking the outskirts, and they're going to start weakening us if we don't, you know, take some measures here to strengthen our borders and stuff. So they were already kind of coming along and trying to take pieces of the empire. So you have groups like the Goths, the Visigoths, the Angles, Saxons, Huns, Franks, Germans, Vikings. They were coming from all over the place seeking a piece of the empire. And as I mentioned earlier, the Goths were able to get in and actually sack the city of Rome in 410. But it wasn't until, and I've already mentioned this before, 476 that the long line of emperors in the history of Rome officially ceased. And that's when the end of the Roman Empire really took place. And that's when, you know, once that really fell apart and dissolved, then that just, you know, opened up the floodgates for all of these groups to basically just come in and start taking their pieces of the pie. You know, the Roman Empire is completely dissolved. All of these groups are like, sweet, right? You know, it's just like vultures on a carcass. They all just came around and tried to grab their piece, basically. And so all of these Scandinavian, all these Germanic peoples came in, and actually this is in a very small nutshell how Europe became what it is today. Each of the groups, like I said, they took a piece of the empire and settled in it, bringing their culture, their new culture, their new language, you know, their new everything, their new society into that particular region. And so, again, that's very much simplified in a nutshell, but that is kind of how Europe came to be the way it is, why this small little area has so many different countries and so many different pieces.
The book said, is it true that most of the, when they conquered areas, most of the areas were abandoned already?
Yeah, there could have been a lot of open land.
There were just the banner left over.
Yeah.
They didn't actually go in and take... A lot of land wasn't taken from the people. They were taken from areas...
I mean, Rome had overextended itself. I mean, really. You know, they started around the Mediterranean, and then they went from... I mean, the Roman Empire extended up to England, but that didn't mean they had, like, a strong enough presence to last there. You know, I mean, Constantine was crowned emperor in York, up in England. So, I mean, that's how vast the empire was, but it was too big, you know, for them to control, basically. So, yeah, there were, like, lands. I mean, they did have to go in and conquer some Romans. You know, it wasn't like there weren't any, you know, there's soldiers. I mean, they had a lot of fighting to do. But, yes, there was a lot of land that would have just been there for the taking. So, so again, like I said, this is where we get even some of the names of these European nations, right? The Franks, they settled where? Germany. No, I'm just kidding. Yes, France. Yes, it was in France. You're right. In France, right? The Germanic tribes settled in Germany. The Angles, where did they settle? England, right? The Angles and the Saxons, right? The Anglo-Saxons, they settled up in England. So you even see in some of the names of these nations, you know, there was a derivative there. And so bringing these new peoples, remember, these are all pagans. They're total, like, you know, they worship a million gods and everything and deities, and they were just total pagan peoples. And so bringing them to an understanding of the Christian faith was going to be a huge challenge. You know, you've got all these Roman citizens and all these people speaking Latin. They're like, how are we going to, you know, especially those that love Jesus and wanted to share him with these newcomers. It's like, okay, how do we do this? How do we, you know, reach these people? Interestingly, and I think this is significant, the founder of the Frank nation, which settled in Roman Gaul, and that became France, okay, in the Roman era it was called Gaul, G-A-U-L, and then, like I said, that became France. He was a guy named Clovis. We'll see, do I have Clovis up here? I don't know.
Missionary.
I have Clovis next week. We'll talk more about him next week, but just to introduce him now, Clovis became the first major barbarian leader to convert to Christianity. And at the time, what's interesting about him is he was the only Orthodox Christian leader, the only one that was stuck to, like, you know, true biblical Christianity. A lot of the other barbarian tribes, when they came to Christ and converted, they adopted Arianism. Because Arianism would make more sense to a barbarian mind. If you have a bunch of, like, gods that are, you know, like, lesser... pagan beings. You know, it's kind of similar to, like, the Roman... You know, the Roman and the Greek gods, a lot of them were... They weren't, like, eternal, right, existent being. A lot of the Greek gods were, like, you know, just a step up from human, right? A lot of them, they're all created. They're all, and the pagan... They had the same kind of mentality, that their gods were created beings and stuff like that. And so Arianism, which said that Jesus was a created being, that would make sense to them. So most of the barbarian tribes were like, oh, okay. They accepted Christianity, but they accepted a heretical form of it. So it was interesting that Clovis did not do that, that he actually was an Orthodox, like really believed the biblical version and the proper view of who Christ was. Kind of interesting, and we'll see why that was so significant more next week. But Clovis's conversion in 496 led to the mass conversion of all his people, and that was a pattern which a lot of the other barbarian nations followed. Once the leader got saved or became a Christian, he just basically forced everybody else to do the same thing. Interestingly, it was the influence of, and here's another shout out to the ladies, the influence of Clovis's wife that led him to the faith. And their descendants, and listen to these names, these are their descendants, Bertha and Ethelbert, these poor people. And then their children were Ethelberga and Edward. It's like, oh, Ethelberga, that poor woman. Anyway, and then Hilda, that was another one. I mean, these are total like Viking, you know, you just picture these burly 9 foot tall women that were, you know, blonde and singing opera. Anyway, Big Bertha, exactly. So their descendants were all very powerful influences. They might have had terrible names, but they were all powerful influences in the spread of the Christian faith to England and all these other parts of mainland Europe to bring, you know, again, the true gospel and biblical Christianity all over Europe. So,
is that about the same time as Winifred?
Winifred, I think she was a little later. Winifred, I can't remember. It was the influence of the women that led the men to Christ in many, many instances, which I thought was kind of interesting, and that in turn went and affected their nation. So, you know, the women aren't completely left out of history. They contributed quite a bit. They were just, like I said earlier, they were very often behind the scenes. Along with the effects of barbarian leaders accepting Christ, urging their people to do the same, there were also early Christian missionaries who bravely stepped out to try to spread the gospel among these new foreigners. They were like, well, we got to find a way to reach them somehow. And so, you know, which was pretty bold, really. I mean, you got these guys taking over the empire, these random people that you've never seen before, that don't speak your language, that don't, you know, I mean... Their culture, everything about them is different, and they're, you know, like I said, because they were warriors, they would probably seem a little more fierce. And yet, there were a lot of brave souls that said, "We still want to bring the love of Jesus to them." So I'm going to list a few of those for you, and that'll be it. That's all we're going to do today. So, woohoo! Early missionaries. Ooh, how about that? Cool, huh? Ooh, Patrick! Yay, Saint Patrick, very well known. Your book talks about him a little bit. But he was actually from Roman Britain, and he was taken captive by the Irish, but after escaping, he felt that the Lord was calling him back to Ireland, to the land of his captivity. And so he made great strides in advancing the gospel in Ireland. He actually played a key role in the abolition of slavery there. I don't know if your book said that or not, but it was kind of cool. Like, you know, because he had been a former slave, he was pretty vocal about speaking against slavery. Also, as we know, he ultimately became the patron saint of Ireland, which is super ironic because he was English. And if you know anything about England and Ireland and Scotland, they all hate each other. So my friend, real good friend of mine, she's Irish, and she said one time in her church years ago, they were talking on forgiveness, and the pastor had everybody in the congregation stand up. He's like, "I want us all to face England and raise our hands, and we're going to forgive England and just let go of all our bitterness towards England." So, I mean, this is deep-rooted stuff, man, from centuries, you know? And so I was like, gosh, I wonder if they all know that Patrick was English. That would probably, like, freak everybody out. Anyway. What?
I'm thinking that could have been legitimate. Maybe they really did have, like, the congregation.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, there totally is. There's so many interesting things that we don't understand in America because we're such a young country. But they have some real deep-seated, like, anger issues and, like, Ben... the way they feel towards, the way the Scots feel towards, I mean, it's just really interesting. They're not like, Yeah, there's just a lot of, not with everybody, but there's just a, you know, there are some, there's some history there, we'll just say. So, Patrick was a solid, godly guy. You can even see this in his writings. I'm going to read something that he wrote in a second. So, in fact, there's a document called St. Patrick's Confession, his Confessio. And somebody said of this, a historian said, it is the devout expression of the belief of a soul which draws its inspiration fresh from the wellsprings of the Holy Scriptures. It is undeniably, conspicuously Protestant, which is interesting. It is distinctly Trinitarian and thoroughly evangelical. And so, I mean, I'll just read for you his own words concerning his missionary vision, just so you can get kind of an idea of the way Patrick thought and who he was. I am not able, nor would it be right, to be silent on such great benefits and such great grace as God has vouchsafed unto me in the land of my captivity. For this is our recompense, that after we have been corrected and brought to know God, we should exalt and confess his wondrous works before every nation which is under the whole of heaven. They will come from the east and the west. They will recline with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, just as we believe that believers will come from all parts of the world. For that reason, consequently, it is indeed our duty to fish well and diligently, as the Lord admonishes in advance and teaches, saying, come after me, and I will make you fishers of people. And again he says, go therefore into the entire world, proclaim the gospel to every creature. So, I mean, pretty solid guy, you know? I mean, he's just quoting scripture there. I mean, he knew the word of God. He loved the Lord. He had a heart to bring the gospel to people. And so I thought that was kind of neat. You know, Patrick wasn't just like this legendary patron saint of Ireland who chased all the snakes out or something like that. There's, I mean, a lot more to him than that. He was a solid, godly guy. Then we have Ulfius, who evangelized the Goths and the Visigoths. As your book says, he translated the Bible into Gothic, which is a huge thing. In fact, he was thought to be the first person to give Gothic a written form. It's not that Gothic wasn't, it was just like an oral language that hadn't been put into writing.
Sure is Gothic.
What, Gothic? The people that have black fingernails, long black, I'm just kidding. That's a good question. I don't know, but I would guess they're more similar to the English stuff because, like, the Druids and all that stuff that are still, like, hang out at Stonehenge and all that. I don't know if I'm right or not. I have no idea.
Like Gaul,
Gaul? That'd be France. If they're from Gaul, they're from France. Yeah. Is that what you're thinking, maybe?
Yeah.
Well, no, but, like,
Scottish.
And that's where they ended up settling.
They did? Yeah, okay. So if they ended up settling in Gaul, that means they settled in a French area. So, that's a good question. Somebody find out where the Goths, you know, came from. All right, Sean's on it. Go TA. But the main thing I wanted to draw out of that is by translating the Bible into Gothic and giving Gothic a written form, I mean, this was huge for the advancement of that language, that culture, you know, to have written their everything written in their own language. And we're going to see this historically with many Christian missionaries, that whenever they would translate the scriptures into the language of the people, it brought great advances and improvements to them. We see this with Wycliffe missionaries. We're going to see this for sure with William Carey, Abner Judson, all of these guys. I mean, it really was significant what they did. They were Scandinavians. Okay, well, a lot of these groups were from Scandinavia, you know, and then you got the Vikings, all the Norse people up there in the north. That makes sense. So, Marin of Tours is next. Marin of Tours, now what's to say about him? He was just a missionary to the Franks in Gaul in France, or which is France. And then Gregory of Tours was also a missionary to the Franks. And then we have Columba. And according to La Tourette, quote, he was a man of striking personality, a born leader, forceful, with quick wrath for injustice to the weak, with tenderness for the poor and for the brute creation, and with simple and deep faith in God. So he was an important missionary to Scotland. He established a monastery on the island of Iona. I've been there. Iona, it was crazy. It was like the middle of June and I almost got frostbite. It was so cold up there. It was like way northern Scotland. Anyway, okay, I probably wasn't going to get frostbite. It felt like it, though. It was pretty cold. Anyway, it was a little wimpy of me. Anyway, though, his monastery there helped keep the scriptures preserved for centuries. So Iona is a very, you know, the monastery at Iona and the history of Iona is very, very significant in church history because of the preservation of the scriptures there, because of all that took place culturally in that monastery. years later, in later years, missionaries were also sent from Iona to England. So, kind of interesting. It's kind of like Patrick, you know, the Englishman going to the Irish, and you've got the Scots going back down to England. So, they're just kind of circling around here.
Robert Murray and Seamus from Scotland, right?
That he was. My brother-in-law is Scottish. He would be so mad at me for even trying to do an accent right now. Anyway, Americans cannot do Scottish accents. It's like one of the hardest ones, I think, personally. Anyway, Columbanus was an Irish missionary. He went all over Europe. He settled in Italy, but like I said, he went everywhere, and he and his followers founded between 60 to 100 monasteries during his lifetime. So that's pretty amazing. He just, you know, scattered all over. And then there's Boniface, who you guys read about. Boniface is one of the, you know, most well-known. Winifred, that's Boniface. I just realized when you said Winifred earlier, I'm like, who's Winifred? That's Boniface's other name, right? So, a.k.a. It's like, my name's Winifred, you can call me Boniface for short. It doesn't even make sense. I don't know what the connection is there, but anyway. An English missionary known as the Apostle to Germany. He came a little bit later on, but he was one of the most significant of the early missionaries in history, so I kind of just lumped him in with these guys, even though he came, like I said, a little bit later. And he advanced the Christian faith throughout the kingdom of the Franks. He also was an important church reformer on the continent, because by the time he came along, a lot of the barbarian paganism had kind of invaded the church, and it was kind of, you know, just tainting a lot of it, the purity of doctrine and stuff. And so he was, you know, trying to reform and get things back on track. So Boniface was really well-known and, you know, famous, and you guys read the legends about him and the tree and all that stuff like that. So that is a brief look at some of the early missionaries. So Christianity adapted, you know? I mean, true Christianity, the true Christian faith is for all people, no matter who or what they are or where they came from. And so, you know, the faith adapted to these crazy political, cultural changes, and the gospel continued to manifest itself somehow in the midst of paganism from the barbarians, in the midst of power trips within the church leadership, in the midst of all of that nonsense, somehow the gospel still shone out and spread. And so at this time we see the end not only of the era of Constantine, but also the end of the Roman Empire. Not only did the Western world have a new face by the end of this era, with all of the barbarian tribes and people groups taking over, but as we know, the church had a new face as well. It wasn't what it had once been in the early church era, and unfortunately that was not for the best, necessarily. It was that church-state marriage thing that we're going to continue to see. So next week, we're going to take a look at the new era ushered in by the coming of the barbarians and the rise of the church's power, a time period known, which we know as the Middle Ages or the Medieval Era, or perhaps, in my opinion, the most appropriate name, the Dark Ages, because spiritually it was a very dark time. So those are all, in case you were wondering, those are all synonymous terms, Middle Ages, Medieval Era, stuff like that. So let's pray, and you're out 15 minutes early. This is amazing, and it probably will never happen again, so really enjoy this.
100
hours. That's right. So, Lord, thank you so much, God. It's true, Lord, nothing can stomp out the gospel, even when we, I mean, as humans, even when we in the church sabotage ourselves, God, and make mistakes, and I mean, you see, like, we're going to continue to see some of the corruption and things that happen, Lord, and yet you always prevail. You always win. You always have the last word, and, you know, truly, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us, Lord. We, you know, at the end of the day, you always have the final say, and we thank you so much for that, God, the fact that you are greater than man, greater than man's mistakes, and so, Lord, how important it is that we look to you and not to man. God, it's just, you know, it's foolish to trust in the arm of man, God. We want to just always continue to trust in the name of the Lord our God and in your word and stay as grounded as possible, Lord. We see that that's what prevails. That's what prevailed in the lives of the testimonies of some of these early church fathers, that those who did the will of God abided forever, and we thank you for that, Lord. So keep us centered and fixed on you and grounded in your word and in your truth, Lord Jesus. And thank you for that lesson. Thank you, Lord, for all that we can learn from these lives. Continue to bless and go before each one here, Lord, as they do the homework and also as they go to any other classes and stuff, just throughout the week at work, Lord. If you have any divine appointments or opportunities for us to share you with those around us this week, Lord, may we be sensitive to your leading and have our eyes open to see those people and those opportunities. So we love you in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks, guys.
I have a visual now on that program, you know. $2.50 for 100 and all, but you actually never.
Oh, yeah. Now you've got it.